call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh. So when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two, one, mine?
Hello and welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast, episode 14, which is a very exciting episode. Curly is here, Jen is here, I am here, and most importantly of all, Les Klinger is here. Hello, Les.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, like we said on Tumblr, Les Klinger has done so much Sherlockian work, annotated editions, consulting for the Guy Ritchie film, doing stories, editing stories together with Laurie Arking. We're very excited to have him here. The first thing that we usually do with people we interview on the podcast, we make them honorary Baker Street babes. And in order to become an honorary babe, you have to answer certain questions. So the first question is, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes?
Well, when I was in law school, which was a long time ago, a very long time ago, you'll know how long ago when I tell you the next part, a new book had just been published that I got a copy of. It was called The Annotated Sherlock Holmes by William Baring-Gould. It came out in 1967. Oh my God, he's old. And in 1968, I received a copy of it as a gift. And I was a serious law student, but I was also serious about allowing a certain amount of recreational reading every night. I started to read the annotated sort of cover to cover, and I was absolutely hooked by the footnotes. I had probably read some Sherlock Holmes stories when I was a kid because I read hundreds and hundreds of books, but I was primarily a science fiction geek, and the Sherlock Holmes stories made no impression on me as a kid or as a teenager. It wasn't until I read the annotated that I discovered this cult of Sherlock Holmes.
It's a proper word for it.
It's the best adjective.
I was fascinated by the idea that there were people studying Holmes. I was fascinated by what was displayed in those footnotes, and I decided I wanted to be like that. I wanted to know everything about Holmes. I went out and I subscribed to the Baker Street Journal, and I began to collect books about Holmes very modestly in the beginning. And that was it. I was hooked for life.
Brilliant. Wow, thank you. The next question is, who's your favorite character or what's your favorite story?
Well, my favorite story is the Blue Carbuncle. I think that that is just the perfect blend of Holmesian deduction, a display of the friendship between Holmes and Watson, and just the atmosphere of wandering around London the day after Christmas. It just all comes together and really works for me.
Perfect. I like that story a lot as well. I watch it at Christmas usually. And do you have a favorite adaptation? But I guess you're sort of biased, maybe, or maybe not, I don't know.
Well, notwithstanding my technical advisor role, I'm very fond of Jeremy Brett's portrayal. And my favorite film is A Study in Terror, made in the 1970s, which you know is a Holmes versus Ripper story. And I just think it's a great mystery. And I love all the character actors that appear in it, especially Anthony Quayle as this kind of mad surgeon.
I want to add a question to our repertoire or whatever it is, because we've been asking it occasionally, and I think it's a good one. If you could have tea with any character from the canon, who would it be?
Wow. There's a lot of tempting choices. you know, Langdale Pike is certainly somebody I would enjoy gossiping with, I'm sure. But I guess I'd stay traditional and say Dr. Watson, and we could chat about Holmes and what a pain he is. And
Sweet. Good choice. I think everyone's chosen Watson so far.
I certainly would.
So predictable.
No, I would have tea with Mrs. Hudson, because you know she has all the dirt.
Well, that's true. That's true.
That's my feeling on the matter.
And then there's Mrs. Turner, who really would dish the dirt.
Oh, yes, this is true.
Why not?
Okay, well, thank you. You are now an honorary Baker Street Babe.
Oh, I'm very excited. Do I put BSB after my name?
Yep.
Great.
Yeah, I'll do that. So, I don't even know what to start talking about, Ferris, because you literally have done everything in the Sherlockian world.
Let's talk about two new books, because that's what writers always want to talk about. The answer to the question of what's the best book you've ever done, it's always, well, the one I just finished. Actually, for some writers, it's the one I'm working on right now. There are two new books out, one, A Study in Sherlock, that you've already mentioned, which is a delicious anthology of stories. I mean, both of the books I'm going to tell you about were ones where my effort was small. A Study in Sherlock is a collection of stories inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon. And I know you've spoken to Laurie King. I'm sure she told you a great deal about it. It was just so exciting to be the editor of that collection. And every story, when it came in, it was like a Christmas present under the tree. These are A-list writers. There's a reason that the stories are really good, which is these are really great writers. But they're all different, and they're just very exciting. I foolishly looked at the Amazon review, and one of the reviewers clearly just didn't get it. They were complaining that the stories weren't very much like Conan Doyle's. Well, of course they weren't. They weren't supposed to be.
They're inspired by.
Exactly. So I mean, actually, angry. One of them is a terrific pastiche, but only one of them. And that's Tom Perry's story in which Holmes gets called off onto a secret mission by President McKinley.
Now, how did you go about choosing the authors for this? Like, did just you and Laurie sit around a table and pick and choose your favorites? Because you got some epic names. You have Neil Gaiman and Lee Child and all sorts.
Well, the whole idea started out because of a panel that I put together for a convention called Left Coast Crime. That was about 3 years ago. And the organizers asked me to do a Sherlockian panel because the most crime convention organizers ask me to do that. It's sort of, you know, okay, we'll put Klinger on a Sherlock Holmes panel. Laurie was going to be there, so it was clearly going to be the two of us. And then I looked at the list of who was attending the convention, and I said to the organizers, okay, I want Michael Connelly, Lee Child, and Jan Burke. And they said, well, those are our guests of honor. I said, I know, but they're friends, and I know that they are all secretly Sherlock Holmes fans, especially Lee Child. If you've read Lee's Jack Reacher novels, there's always quotes from Holmes, references to Holmes, and so on. And I talked with all of them individually about it. So we put together this panel, and the panel was tremendous fun. Every one of them sat up there on the panel and said, well, I don't know very much about Sherlock Holmes, and then would launch into these terrific, sophisticated discussions of the influence of the canon and so on. So out of that, I had the idea that we ask some friends to write stories, and that was the core group. Michael was too busy with a couple of novels, but he's actually our lead-off writer for a second volume that we're putting together.
Oh, yay.
And Lee and Jan Burke said yes. Neil Gaiman said yes right away. Neil's kind of a cheat because he's a Baker Street regular. I mean, he is an irregular, so he's not quite a non-Sherlockian writer. But we aimed at friends of ours who were not publicly associated with Sherlock Holmes. Well, we have another slight cheat in there, Alan Bradley, who writes the delicious Lucia DeFlave novels, Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie, and others. They're terrific mysteries. But Alan wrote a book called Ms. Holmes of Baker Street, one that you should know well, quite a few years ago. And so he's not so closeted about being a Sherlockian. So he was a cheat. Neil was kind of a cheat. But the others, nobody knew that they were secretly great fans of the Master Detective. So
I love that you used delicious as an adjective. I just want to throw that out there. That's a great word.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was just, I had so much fun editing this. Now, the other book that I wanted to mention, just out, is called In the Shadow of Sherlock Holmes. This is from IDW, available at comic book stores as well as bookstores. It's a collection of classic detective fiction. There is actually a Conan Doyle story in the collection. I included The Man with the Watches. But it's stories by writers who have been largely overlooked as a result of the prominence of Sherlock Holmes. And some of them predate the Sherlock Holmes stories. Many of them come in that period right after Holmes disappears over the Reichenbach, when there was a vacuum in the Strand magazine. And so the Strand and other magazines rush to introduce, what shall we say, imitators of Holmes. Some of them are quite good. It's a collection of 22 stories with original illustrations, not by me, brief introductions of each of the writers, and some footnotes. I would call it lightly annotated.
Really? Lightly?
I actually have a question that you brought up about this book, that the Strand and other magazines were trying to fill a hole when Sherlock Holmes was presumed dead. While doing that book, do you find that there were a lot of writers out there who probably could have been as popular, if not more popular, than if Sherlock Holmes hadn't been around?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I think that Conan Doyle is just a grand, natural storyteller. You see it when you read his non-Sherlock Holmes stuff. It wasn't just Holmes that he was good at. And the other writers, some of them are very good, but I don't think they're in Conan Doyle's league. I mean, there are some that might have achieved some success. For example, Arthur Morrison, who wrote the Martin Hewitt stories, was quite good. Some did achieve a lot of success. The Baroness Orczy, I included one of the, quote, old man in the corner stories, the one called The Mysterious Death on the Underground Railway. That was 1901. And she was very successful. She published a large number of novels and stories, including, of course, The Scarlet Pimpernel. Clifford Ashdown was very successful. Dick Donovan. I included a Dick Donovan story. Donovan was prolific in turning out novels, books about crime, as were some others. So there were certainly other successful writers. Could they achieve more success without Holmes? No, I don't think so. I think the opposite. I think Holmes really whetted the appetite for this kind of story.
Awesome. Cool. So you mentioned doing a second volume of studying Sherlock. Are there any other authors that you sort of have on your wish list to get into that one?
Well, I can tell you who we've signed up so far. Sarah Paretsky, we're really excited to have her included in the volume. Cornelia Funke, who has never written mysteries at all, very well known for her children's books and YA books, and wants to play in this sandbox. She loves the Victorian period. She's just writing a series, the first of which is called Reckless, that came out last year. And those are all sort of Victorian street urchin kind of stories. So who knows what she'll turn up, but she wants to do this. We have Lisa Lutz, Denise Hamilton, Megan Abbott, Michael Sims, who you may recall was the distinguished speaker for the Baker Street Irregulars last year. He's a nonfiction writer who's agreed to write a story for us. Michael Derda, whose new book on Conan Doyle is terrific. Michael was hoping to write a story for the first collection, but ran into scheduling problems, and now will be in the second collection. Let me think who I'm leaving off here. Oh, and in the first collection, we have a graphic story by Colin Coterill. So we liked it so much, we wanted to do something like that again. My friends John Repian and Leah Moore, Leah is the daughter of Alan Moore, they are going to write a, let's call it a short comic book for us. They wrote the comic book series called The Trial of Sherlock Holmes that you may have seen, and they're great fans of Holmes and are very eager to do this. So I think that's the list so far. I may be leaving off someone, but that's what I recall.
Well, it sounds like you've got another really, really great lineup for the second volume.
Oh, and Denise Mina, a wonderful Scottish mystery writer. Anthologies don't really do very well. They're a tough sell. So to get Random House to commit, we know that we need to get another group of superstars.
Right.
And they like what we've packaged so far. It's been really interesting to talk to the writers. We just did an event yesterday at a bookstore here in Southern California. We did an event a couple weeks ago at the Poison Pen in Scottsdale to talk to the writers about why they wanted to do this, what interested them, because they get asked all the time to do anthologies. And all of them said pretty much the same thing. First, they said this was kind of the gold standard. You know, to try and write something in the vein of Conan Doyle, while not copying Sherlock Holmes, they thought that that really was a challenge. And second, they really liked the absence of rules. they liked the idea that we weren't saying to them, you have to write a cat mystery set in the White House during Christmas. They really liked the freedom to think about what these stories meant to them and how they've been influenced and what inspired them. And so the result is some really very, very different stories. Neil Gaiman's is a fantasy. Jackie Winspear turns in a lovely story set in the 1920s with a great twist ending. Jan Burke writes a post-World War I story, a period that she's now very interested in, totally different from her contemporary Irene McKelly series. Lee Childs, it's not Jack Reacher. It's a great story called The Boneheaded League. Dana, not a surprise, Dana Stabenow wrote a story set in Alaska with her main character, Kate Shugak, called The IAC Interpreter, which is, as you might guess, a retelling of the Greek interpreter. And one of my favorites, S.J. Roseanne, wrote a story called The Men with the Twisted Lips. And after you've read it, I promise you will never read The Man with the Twisted Lip the same again.
Am I?
I am so excited right now. Also, can I just say that the Cornelia Funke signing on for the second anthology makes me feel a bit proud and a bit patriotic.
There you go. She's a great person. She's a dear friend. And we met at a book event about 4 or 5 years ago now. We were sitting next to each other, and I was like, oh my God, you're Cornelia Funke. We got to be friends. She turned out to be fascinated by Holmes and Victorian stuff. She introduced me, actually, to the producer of the Sherlock Holmes films, the Downey films. And the rest is history. We've swapped books. We've partied. We've dined at each other's homes and so on. So we've become good friends. And I love her books. I love YA generally, but I really like Cornelia's books.
I am going to grab that segue.
go for it.
You were introduced to the producers of the Guy Ritchie films. So how did that come about? Did they already know who you were when they asked you to become an advisor?
They didn't quite ask me. Here's the story. I heard about the film being produced probably about the same time as everybody, way back in 2007, I guess. I knew it was being produced. And I immediately started trying to worm my way into the production. So I used some contacts. As I said, Cornelia introduced me to this fellow, Lionel Wigram, and I think I wrote him a note, and I didn't hear anything. He didn't call me up and didn't get in touch. And meanwhile, there were other channels at work. Another friend of mine introduced me to a fellow who was up to direct the picture. This was before they had selected Guy Ritchie. And the guy came out to my house. I gave him a bunch of books. I read the script, and we talked about approaches to it and so on. He unfortunately didn't get the director's job. Then another friend runs a restaurant here in Malibu where I live, by the way, as does Robert Downey. Robert came into the store and was chatting with the owner of the store about his next project. And he said he's doing Sherlock Holmes. And the owner of the store said, you have to meet Les Klinger. He lives here. He's the world's greatest expert, blah, blah, blah. So actually, the first contact was Robert getting in touch with him saying, could I talk with you about playing Sherlock Holmes? And I said, yeah.
Sure. Twist my arm.
So he came out to the house, and we spent 3 or 4 hours over a meal talking Holmes, talking motivations. I showed him pictures and, of course, the rest of my collection and so on. And that's what really got me in the door. I was not a credited technical advisor on the first film. And by the way, at that point, I did get to meet the producer, and turns out to be a wonderful, lovely fellow, Lionel Wigram. And I think what happened was that he was very nervous about meeting me. Nervous because he was very worried that I was going to turn out to be a purist, a stickler for, you know, gosh, you're doing that, that's terrible, that's wrong. And instead, my attitude toward it was, look, you got to make a commercial film. It's your film. Let me help however I can. If you want my help, great. If you don't want to use my help, that's fine too. So they had me read the script. I went to the set briefly during the first film. And as I said, I had a long talk with Robert. They also asked me at one point, they were trying to cast the role of Moriarty, and you may recall that there were rumors about Brad Pitt playing Moriarty.
Yeah, right.
And Lionel Wigram called me up and said, could you take a meeting with Brad Pitt? And I said, well, yeah. So Brad came out to the house, and we basically did the same thing that I had done with Robert. We talked at great length about Moriarty and how to play him and how it might work to play him as a younger man. And Brad is a very smart and very nice man. Unfortunately, they didn't make it to, or fortunately, because Jared Harris is terrific, they didn't cast him as Moriarty, but that was really fun because when Brad came out here, he came out on his motorcycle, and our neighborhood is a little strange. There's no street signs, and it's hard to find house numbers. So he actually went to the next-door neighbor's house. There was no answer at the next-door neighbor, so he climbed the fence and said, hi, I'm looking for Les Klinger. And they said, oh, he's next door. So when I went out walking the dog the next day, the entire neighborhood knew that Brad Pitt had just been at the house. So in any case, that was the first film. By the end of the film, I was deeply involved, and Warner Bros. Was very kind. They filmed an interview of Robert Downey with me and Robert talking that ended up being edited to about 20 minutes, and there was thought that maybe it would go onto the DVD, but we ended up showing it at the annual dinner of the Baker Street Irregulars. And during the course of that interview, I said to Lionel, because the film had already come out, you know, my wife is really disappointed that I'm not in the credits. And he turned to Susan Downey and said, didn't we try to get less in the credits? Oh, yes. Well, it turns out Warner Brothers has rules that thank you credits are only extended to institutions, like, you know, the city of New York. So I couldn't get a thank you credit, and I wasn't officially the technical advisor, so I couldn't be listed on the screen that way. He said to me, but we'll have to fix that for the next film. We'll have to actually put you on the payroll. I said, oh, no, not that. So sure enough, Warner Brothers Business Affairs Department called me a few months later and said, we want you to be the technical advisor for the sequel. There'll be a contract. You'll be guaranteed a screen credit. And the fee will be X. And I managed to get off a joke I'd been saving up for years. I said, oh, that's interesting. You'll have to give me a few weeks to get the money together. The guy laughed. I'd been telling clients for years that I would be technical advisor on their films if they didn't charge me too much.
So I have to ask, how is Robert Downey Jr., like, as a person? Because he seems like such a really cool, like, very passionate guy.
Very warm and friendly, at least to me. He's been very affectionate. I'm told that he just told our mutual friend who runs the restaurant that he was, quote, ripping me on the Jimmy Kimmel show with his interview, whenever it is. It's one of these nights. He said some nice things about me in the press, and he's just been very kind. He's a lovely guy. His wife, Susan, who has been co-producing the film, very smart. I like Susan a lot. But it's really been an interesting production to be involved with. The three co-producers, Lionel Wigram, Susan Downey, and Robert, have been very collegial. And the feeling on the set is that it's kind of a team effort. Guy Ritchie, the three of them, Jude Law to some extent, you know, they're talking about what to do. They want to stay close to the original dialogue whenever possible. They want touches that, as Robert has said in many interviews, I think, when they're sort of at a loss what to do, they go back to the original stories and see what ideas are there and see what can be adapted. I know that the films have been not everyone's cup of tea. They are clearly commercial films. I'm always quick to say when I'm doing press interviews about the films, you know, there are over 200 Sherlock Holmes films, folks. Why are you picking on this one? None of the 200 have ever been true to the original stories. This one has its heart in the right place, and it's bringing the word, the gospel, to millions of people. So let's be glad.
For sure. Anything that Sherlock Holmes is usually a good thing.
Yes.
Indeed.
What did you think of, because I think probably Robert's Holmes has come under the most scrutiny.
Yes, but we're going to talk about Benedict Cumberbatch, I'm sure. I wish I were involved in advising on that. I wish I could claim credit for being involved. I think it's wonderful. Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat really know their canon, they've done a terrific job of working canonical references in. I have been involved in the publicity a little bit. Scott Monty and I did live tweeting during the broadcast for PBS. PBS asked me to do that. I posted something like 50 or 60 tweets during each of the episodes, trying to point out canonical references and homages that were there in the episodes. I think it's terrific. I think it really works. It's a look at Holmes in the 21st century. It's obviously very different from the Downey films, but a lot of fun.
For sure. Cool. I know. The Radio Times came out recently, along with all these TV guys, because it's not controversy, but I guess waiting for the BBC to actually schedule it. I think what everyone's thinking now is it's going to be New Year's Day will be episode one. But don't quote me on that, obviously.
Great, great. And I know that PBS has said May of next year for American broadcast. I hope they fix it, though. You know, last year when they did the American broadcasts, they actually cut about 5 minutes from each of the episodes.
What?
Yeah. Did you not hear about that?
No.
No. The reasoning behind that is timing purposes. Masterpiece is only allotted so much time, and the full episodes of Sherlock, because the BBC doesn't run commercials, is an hour and a half exactly. And if Masterpiece is only given an hour and a half, they have to allot 5 minutes on both the front end and the back end to get in corporate sponsors, because that's how PBS is paid for, as well as viewer donations, and also to get the introduction in with Alan Cumming, who hosts Masterpiece Mystery.
Right. They didn't do a very good job, however, on the editing. The episode, I've forgotten the name of it, the banker one, the missing one.
The blind banker.
There's the scene, you may recall, where Watson finds this wall with all this strange writing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually takes a picture with his cell phone camera and shows it to Holmes. Well, they cut the scene where Watson discovers the wall. So it's sort of like, where did that come from, that suddenly you got a picture of something to show Holmes? It didn't make any sense. It reminds me of when I was flying over to England a few years ago, and I landed. It was for the Sherlock Holmes Society dinner. And I said to people, I just watched the BBC Hound of the Baskervilles. And they said, what did you think of the drug scene? And I said, what drug scene? Because I had watched it on the airplane, and it was edited. Drugs are not suitable for people flying.
Apparently not.
Oh, muffins.
Save us from editing.
Yes, well, I hope you will get to see the unedited versions when these new ones come out. Though Artie's seeing it in, what, 2-3 days?
Artie is seeing it in 3 days, and I am absolutely beside myself. I'm seeing the BFI preview on Wednesday night. Yeah.
How wonderful. Good for you. Tuesday night, I am going to the premiere of Game of Shadows, so...
Excellent.
Whose shoes would I rather be in?
Well, that's tough. You know, I guess the answer is Artie's, because, you know, Game of Shadows opens a week later. You can go see it.
Well, yeah, that's true.
So I have to wait a month for Sherlock.
I don't want any spoilers.
Well, here's the big spoiler for the Game of Shadows. I mean, I guess you're going to be deeply surprised to find out that this is, of course, the final problem. I mean, that's what this is. It's the final problem. So... we Sherlockians already know the big spoiler.
This is true.
This is true, yes.
I have to wonder, because both the Downey Jr. film and the BBC Sherlock series, they're both the final problem.
Yes.
And it's like, how are Sherlockians going to be able to deal with two Reichenbachs within a month of each other?
Exactly.
It's brutal.
Well, in the olden days, you know, they put more crepe around their arms.
Let's talk about that. That, by the way, turns out to be urban legend only. We've been looking for quite a while for evidence that that really happened, and there just doesn't seem to be any. It's a nice legend, but it does not seem to be true.
I know Caffers is really happy about that story. It's going to break her heart.
The positive thing, though, is that at least we all know that, you know, the empty house comes next.
Sherlockians know the spoiler, but Sherlockians also know the comfort.
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
And people in Victorian times did not.
That's right. Yeah. So let's talk about two other books, not mine. Let's talk about House of Silk and Michael Dirda's on Conan Doyle.
House of Silk.
Okay.
Is that a don't get me started?
We got an advanced copy of it. And so I was being really naughty. I was reading it at work. And I work at Barnes & Noble. So I was ringing someone up. And then they left. And I looked down. And the book was gone. And I'm like, oh my god, I just put this book into this person's bag. So I run out of the store into the mall, like chasing these people down. Being like, I'm sorry, you have a book that you didn't pay for. Like, I have to take it back. And they're like, oh, okay. And I had bought the House in Silk into their bag. So then I went back in. So I almost lost our advanced copy. And I'm sure I would have gotten a lot of trouble had it gone to the wrong hand. So I don't think this family would have cared much. But... I'm just going to put that out there. So don't trust me with advanced copies of things.
So what did you think of it?
I was entertained to a point. I found it too self-referential that it came saying, oh, this reminded me of that time when we talked to this redheaded guy and there was a redheaded lady, blah, 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 blah.
Right. He did work hard at making sure he sort of touched all the notes, I think.
Right. So. I think it's extremely unnecessary. If you're writing... Like, I'm calling it a pastiche because it's a pastiche.
Oh, please don't call it a pastiche. Really, Mr. Horowitz has told us repeatedly it's not a pastiche. It's an homage.
I was reading this homage, and I'm just trying to sound not too snarky. It was just so referential because I've read other pastiches. And not because she's, like, my favorite person ever, but Lindsay's is just beyond fantastic. And she doesn't do that. Like, she stands her ground, and she does it right, and she does the voice correctly. I think Horowitz, he got it at some point, but then it was really not the right voice in others.
I agree. I just wrote a review of the book for the Toronto Globe and Mail that I'm hoping will run soon. I don't know how much of it they're going to use. I was pretty snarky because I kind of felt like that was my job. One of the things about the voice that bothered me was the number of times that Watson sort of moralized, deploring this and wringing his hands about that. Watson just never did that. There's a lot of foreshadowing, too, about little did we know that this would be the worst case, etc. Again, Watson was a better writer than that. He didn't do that sort of thing.
My favorite part is... Horowitz keeps saying, oh, I'm just glad no one guessed the ending. And I totally did. But
of course, so did I. As I said in my review, if you're a student of Victorian history and you know about W.T. Stead's campaign against child prostitution, it's not a real stretch to guess the ending there. But it had a lot of good things going for it. But I'm not a big fan of pastiche generally, I must say. And some of the errors that he made were just whoppers. I mean, I couldn't believe some of them, but... I ended up characterizing them as an effort to write like Watson, complete with errors.
He was getting the continuity messed up, just like Arthur Conan Doyle. Like, he was, remember, because he had that book next to him that had the spirit of Conan Doyle in it.
And, of course, Sherlockians will be very troubled by the beginning. The whole story is set in 1915, very clearly dated, 1915, and he tells us right away Holmes had died just recently. And it's like, what? I said to myself, wait a minute. There's another 20-some stories published after 1915. How come Watson never said anything in those stories about Holmes being dead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, well. On the other hand, there's Michael Dirda's On Conan Doyle, which is one of those books that every once in a while you read and say, gosh, I wish I'd written that. It's a love letter to Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and I don't know if you've talked to Michael ever. He's a wonderful conversationalist, and this is a charming conversation with Michael about the things that he loves and that you love. Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, genre literature in general. And I can't recommend the book highly enough.
Have to pick that one up.
Yeah.
And it's short. It took me, an hour and a half to read it. It's only 40,000 words.
That is short. It's like just over 100 pages.
Yeah, it would still take me 2 days to finish.
Well, there are things to be savored in there. For example, he has his lovely pastiche about Langdale Pike included in this volume. So... I skipped through that. Maybe that's why it took me so fast.
I have to ask you, Jen, since Jen actually interviewed Horowitz 3 episodes ago, whatever.
Something like that, yeah.
Do you have anything to say about the man?
When I did the interview, I was 20 pages from the end. I tried so hard to finish that book prior to the interview. And after I did the interview with him, the last 20 pages, I kind of lost the voice that I originally had, and all I could hear was him. Sometimes it's a hard thing to separate when you read somebody's book. You start hearing their voice versus somebody else's.
It's an interesting process. I must say, I am in awe of fiction writers. I don't do it myself, just a mere footnoter. It takes incredible talent to write anything. And House of Silk, I think I said something like that it was perfectly satisfactory, which is, in my book, very high marks for a pastiche.
Yeah, no, I think people should definitely give it their own shot and don't let what anybody else says deter them. I think it's definitely worth a read.
Yes.
Especially for anybody who is, you know, a Sherlockian or a Holmesian. Read it. Judge for yourself.
Right. It can also be a, can you spot the errors?
Can I ask a question? Seeing as we were just saying about fiction writing, how you don't do it, can we talk about something that you do, which is footnotes, i.e.
Yes.
The Grand Game and the annotated Sherlock Holmes? The Grand Game is just a collection of Sherlockian scholarship. Maybe talk about that, how you went about finding things and putting it together and everything.
Sure.
And with the annotated edition, I mean, how long did that take? Where do you even start?
Well, the answer to the annotated is really simple. You start with Baring Gould. I'm always quick to say that I stood on his shoulders in doing my annotated, and I had three great advantages that he didn't have. Number one is the internet. The internet has turned out to be a remarkable research tool for fact-checking, but also for digging up 19th century literature. There's a great deal of it that's been scanned and is available online. So the internet is a wonderful research tool. That was number one. Number two, the DeWall bibliography, which didn't exist back when Baring Gould was doing his annotations. And number three, I started with Baring Gould. So I did it in a very organized fashion because otherwise I was afraid I'd miss things. I absolutely looked at Baring Gould and I said to myself in general, if Baring Gould had a footnote on something, it was probably something I wanted to write a footnote about. There are subjects that I added, many things that I added to the Baring Gould notes. I did cut the chronological stuff out of the footnotes because that fascinated Baring Gould. He wrote his own chronology, but it didn't interest me much at all, so I moved it all to an appendix. But I also tried to add a lot more Victorian cultural material than Baring Gould had put in, because it interested me. And so I bought lots of Victorian reference books, books written by historians, but also contemporary books, almanacs, gazetteers, Bradshaws, Baedekers, things like that. And you'll see that, especially in the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, which is kind of the academic version of the annotated, long quotations from those sources, and then abbreviated references to them in the Norton version. But I went through Baring Gould, I went through DeWall, and basically looked at everything that DeWall had in the bibliography, sorted out by story. Mm-hmm. And then I had a stack of another 20 books that I had a list, I had literally a checklist, of going through, for example, a Martin Dakin's wonderful book on Holmes, and so on, and just made sure that I went through every one of those 20 books 60 times, once for every story, to comb out all the material in those reference materials. It took about 2.5 years, something like that, to do that.
Oh,
on weekend, you know, weekends and evenings. It actually probably took longer than that, because I was working on the reference library first, and then I did the Norton version, and the Norton version, I thought the Norton version was going to be a snap. Just take all the work I'd done for the reference library and kind of shorten it down a little bit. But no, Norton wanted a lot more material on Victorian culture and that sort of thing. So it was a process. I like to say it was 99% perspiration and not so much inspiration. There are some notes, and I don't think people have really even discovered them all yet. There are some subjects in there where I actually had my own ideas. That's a shocking, I know.
How dare you?
But the Grand Game collection is a very different thing, and that came about because Mike Whalen, the head of the Irregulars, wanted to put out a collection of classical Sherlockian scholarship, and he asked Laurie and me to edit it. And the first thing that we decided to do collectively was to put together kind of a jury. So we went to, I think it was 8 people who are well known in the field, you know, Chris Redmond, Nick Utekin, people like that, Andy Peck. We asked them to give us essentially sort of their top 10 selections of Sherlockian scholarship. And they did. So we got in all of those candidates. And then I sat there and looked at the list and said, how could they leave off this? And I probably doubled the list, adding stuff that I had found to be highly valuable. And then Laurie and I went through and read everything and debated which ones would make the final cut. We ended up, with the generosity of the BSI, not having to cut a lot. We ended up shortening it down. Maybe we dropped 20 essays for each volume. I mean, we had started with a list of 80, and then we cut it down to 60. I mean, there's a lot of material in each of those volumes. If they each, you haven't even seen the second volume yet. Second volume comes out in January, and it's 1950 through the present. And it was such a pleasure to reread those wonderful pieces of scholarship. And of course, we did not restrict ourselves to the Baker Street Journal. I wanted to make very sure that we included not only other Science Society journals, the Sydney Passengers Log, I mean, dozens of other journals that produce high quality Sherlockian scholarship. But I also wanted to be sure that we excerpted books. This wasn't supposed to be just articles that appeared in periodicals. I thought we needed representative samples of some of the great book writing. For example, Baring Gould wrote some terrific essays in the annotated Sherlock Holmes, and people forget that. They only think about the footnotes.
Before we go on, I'm actually going to have to say goodbye.
Yeah, you guys did good work.
Thank you.
But I actually had one last question that I wanted to ask you, because you just brought up a really good point. You spent 2.5+ years working on the annotated, plus doing all this other stuff in between, and you're obviously still in love with Sherlock Holmes. Do you ever fear you'll lose interest, one, or B, you'll reach the end of the line and there just isn't anything else for you to look into and when it comes to Sherlock Holmes?
Very good question. I mean, it really is, because there are certainly times when I scratch my head and say, oh, I need to produce a Christmas booklet. I need to do something for this or that, or give a talk. And what am I going to write about? No, I think the canon is endlessly delicious. There are countless things that need to be explored, haven't been explored. And, of course, I can always get started on the new annotated Sherlock Holmes. it's hard for me to think that it's already been essentially 8 years, almost 9 years, since I turned in to Norton the manuscript of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes. And so there's new scholarship that's been published. And certainly, it probably won't be me, but someone will pick it up 15 years from now and say, oh, this book needs to be updated because there's a whole new generation of scholarship that's been published. There's some great articles. There's some great books that have been published. But, I mean, meantime, I'm keeping myself busy with other projects. You know, I've gone on to do vampire books. This year, I've done 3 anthologies, and anthologies are new for me in general, and they're really fun. And I've been hard at work on my next big book, which comes out from W.W. Norton in 2015, which is the annotated H.P. Lovecraft.
Ooh.
Also, we're finishing up the annotated Sandman, the first volume of which comes out in January.
All right.
That's all essentially done. Sandman is done, but Neil Gaiman is still editing it, so there's some rewriting going on as we go through that process. But the first volume is done. It'll be out January 4th, and the second volume will be out sometime later in 2012.
Wow. All right, well, thank you very much for answering my last question. Continue on without me, and Les, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right, talk to you guys soon.
Hi, Jen.
Bye.
Okay, I won't keep you much longer. We just have, like, I think 3 questions from listeners, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
First off, from Steve Booth. He says, I look forward to this interview that you're doing. I would like to know if there are any plans for a future electronic version of the annotated volumes, or perhaps even a well-conceived interactive smartphone app so we can have Holmes on the go.
It's a great question. I've been asked it a lot. It's up to Norton. It's not up to me. They have been thinking about it. It's going to take some work because you have to turn all those notes into hyperlinks to make it really valuable. But I guess the short answer is not soon. It's not on the horizon soon. There is, by the way, an electronic edition of A Study in Sherlock.
Okay.
Well, yeah, that's good to know.
Okay. And I guess the rest of the...
Oh, and there will be an electronic edition of In the Shadow of Sherlock Holmes. IDW is going to publish that for the Kindle, too.
Queens.
Excellent.
Okay. And the rest of these have to do with the Guy Ritchie films. So these are from Tumblr. So Dr. John H. Watson asks, was there any time on the set or talking with the producers that they had something that totally went against canon so much that you had to put your foot down?
Well, as I said earlier, putting my foot down makes it sound a little strong, but sure. As I said, you win some, you lose some. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the first film, there's a scene you may recall where the camera dollies up to the outside of Holmes's residence, and we see this glass globe, and it says in big letters on it, 221B. Mm-hmm. And I said, we need to lose the B, because Sherlockians all know that the B was really an apartment designation. It wasn't the street address. And they said, no. They said, the public expects it. We don't care that it's inaccurate. It's literary license. We're going to leave the B on there. Okay, so I lost that one. But then there was a scene in which, in the background, and nobody will notice this stuff, in the background, Lestrade is talking to Mrs. Hudson, and Lestrade is saying something to her about a prior case that he and Holmes had worked on. And when I read it, I said, that's wrong. It's wrong because, first of all, Lestrade wasn't involved in the case, and second, it took place after the events. They said, so fix it. And I wrote two lines of dialogue that referred to some other case and made it canonical. And so there are certainly ones like that that I won. When I was sitting on the set, but I want to tell you the degree of attention, which has been paid to detail by Warner Brothers, and so there weren't a lot of needs for me to put my foot down. We were sitting on the set watching a scene being shot that involved some tarot cards. And I think it may have actually appeared in the trailer already, or it's in mm-hmm. some of the stuff that's been shown. And I suddenly had this nervousness that this was going to be a problem, because the Rider-Waite deck, which is the famous deck of tarot cards, wasn't published until like 1910. So the producers got nervous. We called the art department. The art department came up with an inch-thick folder of their research into tarot cards and showed us that they had used an authentic 19th century French tarot deck for the props here. And, I mean, we're talking about a detail. These cards are on camera for maybe 10 seconds, and yet Warner Brothers Art Department had done, obviously, dozens of hours of research into what those cards should look like. So they're already doing this. My role has been to basically, in a lot of cases, say, great job.
Good job.
And they've been using my books on the set. And I also have told Steve Doyle they have Sherlock Holmes for Dummies on the set and have been using all of that stuff as reference material whenever they needed to. Interestingly, however, they had somehow missed, or at least the producers missed, the Sidney Paget illustrations of the Greek interpreter. And I showed them the picture of Mycroft and showed them that it was Stephen Fry.
Yeah.
They were like, oh my God.
No, Stephen Fry is perfect for that role.
Yes.
Definitely.
So excited. We do have one that can't be avoided. Irene Adler. In the films, your thoughts on what they did with that?
She's not the way I pictured her. But there's a nice chemistry. It's just not the Irene Adler I had in my head. I had something more exotic in mind, I think. Okay, she's supposed to be American. And so maybe the exotic image in my mind of, you know, Nyree Dawn Porter or somebody, or Gail Hunnicutt or one of those, is just wrong. It's not really who Irene Adler was. She was an American. And Rachel McAdams is probably closer to the way she really was. But I don't really picture Rachel McAdams doing opera.
No. The girl who's playing Irene for the BBC Sherlock, Laura Prolvar, she actually is a singer. So she has that going.
Great.
About the romance that they threw in there.
Well, you know, I mean, they're certainly not the first to speculate that way. I mean, mm-hmm. Beringold, for goodness sake, actually had them have a child together.
Right.
People have forgotten that part about Baron Gould, that he got a little wild here. His speculations were a little bit crazy.
I've started reading Telecoms of Baker Street, the alleged biography, and some of the things I'm just, oh, okay, so that's an idea that came from Baron Gould. Right, I thought that was, you know, a crazy thing that later people came up with, but no, he came up with a lot of crazy things.
Yep.
Okay, and one last question by the Knights of the Deal topped table. Does Holmes wake up early or late?
Yes. Very good question. And there's a long section in Ian Davies' book about the breakfast table at Baker Street and how contradictory it is. Sometimes he's up early, sometimes Holmes is up all night, and sometimes he sleeps in late. So I think my answer is right. It's both.
All right, cool. That's all the questions we have.
Good, because I don't like questions that actually have answers. I, a long time ago, decided that I would never do any more Sherlockian quizzes because there was no upside. If I get it right, they say, sure, he annotated the canon. Of course he knows the answer. And if I get it wrong, they say, oh, well, I don't want to buy his books.
Oh. Oh, my. Thank you so much for...
You're very welcome. And should get in one more plug. Christina and I had the pleasure of attending the From Gillette to Brett 3 conference in Bloomington, Indiana, a few weeks ago. And I just want to remind your viewers that the Baker Street Irregulars are putting together a conference that will be held in Los Angeles next Labor Day weekend in 2012 called Behind the Sherlockian Screen. It's an academic conference co-sponsored by UCLA on canonical film. It's not a film festival. It's really an academic conference looking at the history of the films, the technical craft of producing period films, and so on. It should be terrific.
Yes.
That sounds exciting.
And I'm co-chairing it.
Oh, well, there you go. Cool beans.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on the show.
Yes,
thank you so much for coming.
I look forward to telling everyone now that I'm an honorary babe.
There you go. Spread that around.
Okay. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thank you, Les.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello, this is Maria. And you might have heard my voice before on the second Baker Street Babes podcast, which happened quite a while ago, which is fascinating to see how many episodes there have been already. But today I'm going to talk a bit about the German Sherlock Holmes Society and their support for Undershaw. I'm a representative for the Undershaw Preservation Trust, one of the German representatives, so I thought it might be a good idea to contact the German Sherlock Holmes Society, which I did a while ago, and I was really quite amazed because the interest is absolutely there and within the German Sherlock Holmes Society. So people have been aware of it, but have not really been able to talk about it or find a platform, a proper platform to do it or really have some inside information on the problem. And so it was really quite amazing to start communicating with them because they were absolutely interested in what's going on and trying to help in every way possible. So really, really quickly, they put up a link on their homepage to unsafeundershore.com and started thinking of ways in which, you know, we could spread the word in Germany. So I actually got to write an article in the Sherlock Holmes Chronicle, which is their members' magazine, and gave a bit of background information on, you know, what actually what is Undershaw and how it was important to Doyle and his family back then, and how it is still kind of important to everybody who is interested in Doyle or in history or in Sherlock Holmes. So it's really quite right. It was really quite lovely to be able to share a bit of that and raise awareness. And they also, just now for Christmas, that's going to come out, have a calendar, and Undershaw actually gets July, which is lovely. So there's a few pictures and a bit of information on that too. So people actually who buy the calendar, which is full of illustrations from the books, do also get to know a bit about Undershaw. And I think a part of the money that you pay for it, which is pretty much just for printing, actually goes to the Undershaw Preservation Trust, which is also very lovely. And really, really nice. So the support by the German Sherlock Holmes Society has actually been kind of overwhelming. I'd never thought that it would actually, you know, actually become a collaboration of kind. So this is really lovely to know that even here with Sherlock Holmes, I mean, Sherlock Holmes is really famous, but it's still, there's still kind of a way to go. And I think the Ritchie and the BBC Sherlock Holmes versions are helping, especially with young people who might have heard of him but probably haven't read Sherlock Holmes, to raise awareness to that. And so it's really quite lovely to have this collaboration of the German Sherlock Holmes Society, who are not only celebrating Sherlock Holmes but also helping the Undershaw Preservation Trust in many, many ways lately. And something really amazing that's going to happen next year is the Sherlockon, which is a convention to celebrate the 125th anniversary of Sherlock Holmes. So that's going to be next year, and I think it will be right in August, from the 24th to the 26th, on Burg Lissingen, which is in Germany, obviously. You can actually just Google Sherlockon, so it's like Sherlock, and just exchange the K in the end with an O and an N, and then you have the Sherlockon. And you can find all the information that you need on that homepage. So I think this is about all the information that I can give you right now about this. Oh, you can actually buy the calendar, of course, if you go to the German Sherlock Holmes Society's homepage as well, which you can just type into Google and it should be the first thing that pops up. And buy the calendar and help Undershaw and help the German Sherlock Holmes Society and just celebrate a bit of Sherlock Holmes next year for the 125th anniversary, which is really quite lovely. And hopefully, I mean, that's what everybody's hoping, that some positive things will be happening with Undershaw, especially in the year of the anniversary of Sherlock Holmes. So this is it from me, and I'll just hand this over back to Curly then. Bye-bye. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?